Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Here, a pretty bearish report, really. How come the bottom didn't just fall out?
K-State grain economist Dan O'Brien on the latest USDA report.
I think that the market sort of digested this report and said, hey, I see what you're saying. Fair enough. But we're concerned about weather in Brazil and Argentina right now. You know, the impact of the switch from La Nina to El Nino. We have dry or too wet conditions affecting planting of a lot of replanting of soybeans. What'll end up and be delayed planting for the second corn crop because of these delays for soybeans there in Brazil. So you have other issues that are at least as much in the mind and the eyesight, the focus of the grain markets in this USDA report. And because of that, here we have some bearish numbers, and we just had a moderate bearish response in my view.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Geese 2023 corn closed down 8 cents to 468, which surprisingly, to me anyway, a couple days ago, earlier this week, it traded at 468, had an up day, and then with this negative news, it basically traded back to where it was earlier in the week.
Kansas State grain economist Dan O'Brien on why the markets didn't react following a bearish report.
So that you can take that different ways. To me, it's that, there's bigger corn production than we thought. So we didn't see the bottom necessarily drop out of the market, but went back to kind of this quote comfortable level of 468. And there is carry in the market from Dece to March 24, about just under 5 cents a bushel, about 4 3/8. From March to May to July, about 4.5. So the market right now with large supplies, again, came out with a projection of 15.2 billion bushels. I think basically the highest on record. Still, market is telling producers to store. You know, it's a carrying charge market. And you look at the other major concern out of this report in the soybean market, came in with a little bit higher, not as proportionally as large an increase in production for beans, but saw the market close at 13.27. The November contract, now it's in delivery at 13.27 three quarters, the one that we're really following more closely now, the January contract, 13.43.5. And again, not just a falling out of bed response to what could have been viewed pretty bearishly in the market, a drop of 22 cents basically. But again, you've got, even in soybeans, which is surprising because you do have South American crops that we normally think, well, they're going to come. So they're coming here in the next few months. Why get all excited? But we have carrying charges of 7 cents a month from January to March to May, 6 cents a month, and then the carry falls off in July. So again, the market with a larger crop coming is giving short-term signals to just hold it, you know, hold the grain, we'll come for it later on. So either on farm, in elevators, whichever, but that it's basically covering storage costs right now. And I would say wheat also closed down, but we've seen some underlying support, I think, for wheat. If anything, you look at the wheat chart, which had been going down at a 45-degree angle for a good while, now seems to be, for a little bit anyway, heading sideways. So it took this day in stride, went down about the same amount, a little less than corn, and established, again, a closure for December at 647.25. Interesting, next July, sitting there at had closed at 672. So you've got gains into next spring. So interesting to watch.
And on sorghum?
Grain sorghum. It's interesting. You know, most of the market is looking at everything else. But for us in Kansas, grain sorghum is a pretty good deal. And the USDA dropped the production estimate for grain sorghum from 360 million bushels down to 322, tightened up the supply-demand balance sheet a little bit. Now, I would argue with the USDA on one thing they did. Whereas for the corn market price, they dropped it from 495 to 485. Well, they did the same thing for grain sorghum. But when you look at these cash markets, where we're at, we've got stronger than that cash market. So I guess I'd have a bone of contention with my friends in USDA that I'm not so sure the grain sorghum price is going down as much as they're talking about. Anyway, but when you look at grain sorghum prices, again, that 503 in Topeka versus corn at 458, 513 in Salina versus 468 in cash, 528 and 541 in Hutchinson and Columbus versus 483, 463. So sorghum prices, along with their strong bought ahead export numbers, are probably better, at least from my perspective, than maybe the USDA is appreciating in this report.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It's an interesting topic and an interesting title. Let's talk about how we get there and the purpose of this week's topic.
Not just talking scoring, but manure scoring. It's Dr. Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State Beef Breeding Specialist.
Where we're weaning calves, if we haven't done it already, we're getting ready to wean calves. If we just weaned a calf off, it's that time of the year when she's going to be at about her lowest body condition. She'll put some back on going into calving season. We know at the beginning of calving season, we'd like to have our mature cows in a body condition score of 5+, our bred heifers at a body condition score of 6, and that's going to enable them to turn around and have prompt breed back so that they're breeding up quick enough to repeat the process and wean off another calf in that 12-month window. So monitoring body condition scores, as we've talked about before on this show, is a very important method to manage cows, keep them in the right plane of nutrition. But manure scoring is something we can look at more in the short term and on a day-to-day basis have a better feel for whether or not we're meeting particularly the protein requirements in our cow herd. Now, looking at manure out of our cows can indicate a lot of things, and some of them are health-related. But just with respect to where we're at right now in Oklahoma, if we've got ample standing forage, it's a pretty safe assumption that that forage is in the process of going dormant. The quality, the nutritional content, and particularly the crude protein content of that grass is going down. And so it's the time of year if we need to be giving our cows a bit of a nutritional boost. Some protein supplementation is going to be key in helping them utilize and maximize that digestibility of that standing forage we've got on hand. If we look at manure scores, basically, if we are seeing a manure score of about 1, and manure scores range from 1 to 5, where 1 is something that looks like what we may identify in Oklahoma as the consistency of calves growing on wheat pasture. A manure score of 1 has got more moisture in the manure than it does solids. It's about the consistency of cream soup. Splatters, makes a really flat pad. We go on up in how solid it gets to a manure score 3, which is typically something that only piles about 2 inches deep out of a mature cow, actually pools a little bit in the center. And that's the manure score we're looking for this time of year. It means that nutritional quantity, quality, everything in terms of requirements are being met. The rate of passage is about where we want it. And we'd like to see a manure score of 3. And then all the way out to a manure score of 5, which is what we're prone to see more of this time of year. A manure score that indicates we're not getting enough protein in the diet. There's a lot of fiber. Rate of passage is slow. These are the pats of manure that can literally get 4 to 6 inches tall. An eyeball score of manure pats this time of year can tell us if we need to be adding some protein to the diet. A little bit of protein supplementation, and if we see those really liquid manure scores of 1 and 2, we know we may be overdoing it, and we can back off a little bit in those cubes that we're actually supplementing into the cow's diet. If we're looking at something that's about a 3, we know we're getting what we need into those cows. And if we're seeing manure score 4s and 5s, those ones that pile really deep, we know we need to be getting more protein supplementation into those cows' diets. Manure scoring is a quick and easy to use management tool, something we can take a look at with the naked eye on a day-to-day basis. And it's pretty informative in terms of helping us make some nutritional management decisions.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A multilateral trading system is a global public good. I've termed it that. It's a global public good. And we need multilateralism to solve some problems.
The Director General of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala.
I think my childhood, I was very, very fortunate to be brought up by first my grandmother until I was 8+, almost 9, because my parents were studying abroad and they were on scholarship in Germany, and so they couldn't take me. They didn't have enough money, so they left me with my grandmother, who was a loving and very disciplined person. But she was also about community. and learning that it's life is not about yourself, but about how you serve your community was very important. And learning skills very early in life. You know, I learned how to cook by the time I was that 8 years old. And to make sure that I help with the house, and I went to the farm and the stream. I think all those things have influenced who I am. My parents came back, and both of them became university academics, by the way. And I think that continuation of the theme of service, education is not about yourself. Is about what you can use it to do for others. Really continued with my parents, and in particular my father, who thought, you know, his daughters in particular could do and should do everything, and my five brothers too. So that has led me into a career of service, both nationally and internationally, and into the WTO. Because for me, the question I always ask myself in any assignment is, how is it going to help others? If it will serve others and make a difference, then I'm in. If it will not, then I'm not excited about it.
But why are trade tensions increasing?
The reason the rhetoric against and the tension is high, on at least on the trade side, is the feeling that some members, and say China, may be pursuing practices in subsidizing their enterprises that may go against the level playing field that the WTO supports. And if you talk to China, China will tell you that they're also concerned that some other types of subsidies, including agricultural subsidies, may be also going against the level playing field, and some of the countries in the West are doing that. So what is WTO members, especially the large countries and the developing countries too, all have complaints about level playing field issues. This is fueling some of the suspicion and the aggravation and the talk against trade. So let me end by saying, look, let us not let our sentiments run away with the actual facts. We are working now to look at, lay out the facts on subsidies across the board. From the WTO, we've joined with the World Bank and the IMF and the OECD, all these international organizations, to look at this issue and try to get the facts on the table so that we can begin a conversation that can actually lead us to do away with these suspicions and try and restore the balance in terms of how the trade is being seen and perceived.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The November crop report, it's not the last crop report for this year, but it's an important one.
K-State grain economist Dan O'Brien on why the most recent USDA report is important.
We do have one more time of survey data presentation by the USDA. That'll be in January in that big combined mass of reports that happen. But this sort of sets the stage in terms of what the market thinks it has, supply-demand wise, domestically in the U.S. anyway, for the next couple of months. So we've just laid down foundation for a lot of, for November through December and early January, where the grain market's going to go.
So what's ahead?
On corn, the USDA came in, they were at 173.9 bushels per acre. Last, in the October report, they came in at 174.9, so raised it to still not 177. So there are effects of the drought here in the U.S., but by the time you run them, a 15.23 billion bushel crop through the supply-demand balance sheet, you end up with ending stocks that are still well over 2 billion at 2.156, and really 2 billion and somewhere around 8, 9, 10% stocks juice is really kind of a break even. So we have the view that we have pretty good corn crop, pretty good supplies. We're not worried about any major shortfall unless demand would really pick up. And by the way, demand would pick up if they have major crop problems down South America. But as we stand right now, again, we have the evidence to put us at just about 460, 470 for corn futures. And for soybeans, again, a little bit of an increase in the supply-demand balance sheet for U.S. soybeans, but the ending stocks figure increased from 220, 245, 246 million bushels ending stocks, still pretty tight situation. And again, we're looking at strong exports. Problems in South America right now are sending buyers to our shores. And we had 82 million bushels of exports, actual shipments, the week ending November the 2nd, and we need about 31 to meet the USDA's projection. But, of course, we've got about a 4 to 6 month window before the South American crop comes. But as it is right now, I think one thing, again, that you and I talked about before we came on there, one positive aspect, a silver lining of this is that, hey, we've got a moderation in prices, somewhat low. World buyers in the last week have come in and seen this as an opportunity. So they've kind of viewed this November report. They're kind of acting like they think it's the low because they're buying. So I think that's something to watch and gives us hope for a base in these markets being built for the corn and soybean markets and some strength that would be coming in. And these are the type of factors that anybody storing these grains instead of selling them are trying to deduce and figure out in terms of what the potential is for things to move higher. I think as we sit today, it looks like we're not looking for the best soybean crop. Some disappointments in Brazil in particular for their soybean crop. And right now you do see the soybean to corn new crop price ratios for 2025 futures strongly favoring soybeans. It does set us up, I'm thinking, Shelby, for strong price competition for acres in the spring. So it's one thing to have at this time sitting here in November to have strong signals to plant soybeans next year, but will the corn market tolerate that? You know, we have a lot of corn industry that wants to have supplies too. So to me, with what we're seeing in soybeans, what isn't isolated to soybeans, it's going to affect corn eventually when we start to make acreage decisions out there in 2025. And of course, if it's dry right now, if we have any problems through the winter, that will lend us some price strength for wheat heading off once we break dormancy off into March, early April. So that's another factor to watch.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
USDA released a bearish cattle on feed report in October, showing cattle on feed at 11.5 million head, the second highest figure on record. Barrett Nelson, American Farm Bureau Federation economist, explains what this means for cattle markets going forward.
We have a lot of cattle that are being placed on feed, and a very high percentage, near 40% of those cattle are still heifers. And in the short run, this means that we're going to have a very high supply of cattle coming to market at one point in time. But in the long run, this takes a lot of cattle out of the market that could have otherwise been held back for replacements.
Replacements are what help rebuild herds following a dip in herd size.
Replacement heifers are basically the planting intentions of the cattle business. So when we have less of those replacement heifers being held back to produce calves, we ultimately have a smaller inventory. We've been going through this for a couple of years now, but now as this happens, we're looking at 2024 at the earliest before we can even consider starting to replace this cattle herd.
Nelson says consumers will likely feel the pinch of higher beef prices next year.
So what this means for consumers is record beef prices in 2024 and 2025. A lot of the economy situations, we're talking about recession, we're still talking about inflation and where our money's at, are going to dictate the ability of the economy to sustain these high beef prices or if consumers will start switching over to other substitutes like pork and chicken.
Learn more on the market intel page at FB.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Allie Groats, a grad research assistant at Oklahoma State, on a project crossing beef and dairy cattle genetics.
So we are at the Marvin Clemmy Research Range out here in Bessie, Oklahoma, where I currently have some cattle on trial at. The research that I'm interested in right now and what we're doing out here is in the last few years, we've had this big increase in dairy beef calves entering the feedlot system, but there's been a little work in their post-weaning management. So right now out here, we have 150 head. 75 of them are dairy beef crossbred steers, and then 75 are just native straight beef cattle. We're seeing how they do on pasture and their gain, and then we're supplementing them with some DDG cubes, and we'll be getting them off here in a couple weeks and seeing how they do. And then alongside of them, we also have some calves up in Buffalo, Oklahoma at Buffalo Feeders that we will eventually be able to compare the two together because those calves went straight 2 feet up in Buffalo where these guys have been grazing the lovely grass that's out here. These dairy beef calves are performing about the same as the native beef calves, maybe just a little bit less. The the beef calves are still going to outperform them in some aspects. But what we've seen is that these dairy beef crosses are really complementing that beef side and letting that dairy side behind. So that way they're doing better in the feedlot. I would say that they are pretty even, and I think that we'll get some really cool data from these guys running them alongside. I'll be interested once they go to slaughter their carcass data, but I think weight-wise right now they're looking really great and really similar to each other. So it would be a better management practice for these dairy calves. They'd have a better quality of life, better carcass data at the end, all of those things. And so it would also be a great opportunity for these stocker producers. And it's a great opportunity for dairy producers as well, because they're able to take those lower genetic females that they have that they still want a new lactation on but don't want to keep the calf for replacement females. And they can get these dairy beef crosses that they then can sell to a calf ranch, and the calf ranch can then take to stockers, and stockers can then take them to feedlots instead of feeding them like your traditional dairy calf and not having as much use for them or as much value in them. We're getting, they'll have a lot more value at the end in these dairy beef crosses.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Very fascinating for me to watch, because now all the talk is about, you know, is this going to be, you know, a bipartisan bill? And I sort of chuckle because both of them that I work on started as bipartisan bills. There were months and months and months of bipartisan
work. Dr. Bart Fisher is co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
There is no question that, I should say, I'm never going to be surprised when the final product ends up looking drastically different from the one that was initially drafted, because ultimately it takes 218 votes in the House and generally 60 votes in the Senate to get anything done. And ultimately, a lot of compromise is made along the way to get to that point.
On the conservation title,
a couple of key thoughts there. One, you know, on the substance of conservation here in a second, you know, is that, I mean, certainly Capitol Hill on the Democratic side of the aisle misses someone, you know, Mr. Peterson's stature, because, I mean, as you mentioned, he was a stalwart for ag policy for decades. And, you know, I worked on the other side of the aisle, but, you know, we often work together with him directly and with his team on issues over time. And so, you know, having him not there is certainly a loss. But with that said, other folks have really stepped up to the plate. And so I think we've got a great slate of, you know, of leaders going into this farm bill. It's not a question of whether they can get it done. It's a question of whether the stars will align, because there's a lot of moving parts and there's a lot going on just in terms of, you know, the broader geopolitical debate, you know, against which this farm bill is being negotiated. On the substance of conservation, I think one of the most notable things to monitor right now is that, you know, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act that passed in the last Congress, of course, that was the Congress where both, you know, the legislature, both chambers in the legislature, and then also the White House were all under single-party control, you know, Democratic control. And so the IRA passed along partisan lines, and that bill included a significant infusion for Title II of the Farm Bill, the conservation title, about $20 billion in budget authority, which we think, you know, is going to translate to, you know, $15 to $16 billion in actual spending. To get that done, though, they largely reauthorized Title II in the IRA. And so we're now looking at doing a farm bill that's arguably to reauthorize all these various provisions, and Title II's already been, conservation's already been reauthorized. And you look at that against the backdrop of the rest of the bill. You know, for all the talk that you're going to hear about on nutrition, nutrition is kind of a quasi-permanent bill. Even without a farm bill, the appropriators can continue to fund it. And crop insurance is actually permanent law. So when you start to look at what this farm bill is, what we're actually going to be reauthorizing in this farm bill, certainly there's several small things. But one of the bigger ticket, most notable items is Title I, kind of the traditional reason for doing a farm bill. And so a lot of the farm bill has already been dealt with. And the big question mark is going to be what happens on Title I. The last point I would note there then is on Title II is, you know, given that big infusion, what is that going to do to the dynamic? Because the way they set it up last fall, it's only through 2026, the authority through 2026, which is about the midpoint of this bill. And I can already, I mean, I can hear the talking points and the headlines now is that, well, now there's a conservation cliff and we've got to pour more money into Title II of the Farm Bill to stave off the nutrition or the conservation cliff. You hear it very similarly on nutrition too, because of all the temporary funding that was added during the pandemic. And so politics being, you know, what it is, I suspect, you know, that despite that huge infusion last fall, there's going to be more talk to plowing additional money into conservation, primarily under the auspices of dealing with climate change, responding to climate change. But I think, you know, the bigger fault line is going to be how much is going to be added to Title I of the Farm Bill and how much is going to be needed in Title I to make some improvements that make passing a Farm Bill worthwhile.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Ballots arrive this week for eligible voters in USDA Farm Service Agency County Committee elections.
There's about 7,700 producers nationwide that serve on more than 2,200 county committees. County committees are comprised from 3 to 11 elected members from their local administrative areas, and each member will serve a three-year term.
FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau says voters have until December 4th to turn in their ballots to their local FSA offices, either by mail or in person.
Once elected, the county committees will come together. New members will be oriented to the position, and they will go right to work after the first of the year, serving their local producers in the delivery of policy and programs at the Farm Service Agency.
For more information about FSA county committees or the county committee nomination and election process,
you can find a lot of that information at fsa.usda.gov/elections. You can also stop in at your local office.
I'm Ron Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.